Hi, this is Tony Ganon, and you need more front wing. And I love that. That's my favorite word when I tell my engineer.
Hello and welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. I'm Steph Walcraft, and I think that Paul may have been taking the comments on Twitter a little bit personally, where people have been saying that he hasn't been talking enough lately. he asked if we could do this on our own this week. So
I didn't even see those. Oh, those comments. Okay.
Yeah. Props to James Black at 16th and Georgetown for calling us out for not letting Paul talk enough. So
hey,
we're going to let him
too.
Talk tonight.
Hi, Christy.
And while we're talking about Paul, you may, at various points in the podcast this evening, hear some crickets chirping in the background. Paul is sitting in his backyard with a nice little campfire going and enjoying the nice weather. So it's a true fireside chat tonight.
It's a beautiful evening at the Midwest More Front Wing outpost here.
So, yes, let's all sit around the campfire and get a nice adult beverage. I'm currently enjoying a soda water, but
that reminds me, I do have my Diet Cherry Limeade that I left inside, so I might have to depart company as you go on a tirade here so I can go get it.
Well, you're bound to get an opportunity. So the good thing is that we do have an awful lot to talk about this week. There were plenty of things to discuss out of the Indy Japan, the final, this past Saturday, Sunday, depending on what part of the world you were in. So let's get right to it. I'll let you go first, Paul. Give us your overall impressions of the race.
I think overall impressions, it was kind of what we expected. When we spoke with Ryan Briscoe a few weeks ago, he said it was somewhere between, what did he say, like a barber in a mid-Ohio, which basically is like a sleeper in a snooze fest. So I wasn't expecting much out of it. The way it played out, there were some controversial moves, but all in all, I think it was kind of pretty much what we expected. It was whoever won the pole, unless they did something dumb or had some really bad luck, they were going to win the race. As it turned out, Dixon basically just walked away with it, never really challenged, even on the restarts, you know, on the legal restarts, he wasn't really even challenged. So, yeah, it looks like it could be a nice road course, but it didn't work well with these cars like most of the road courses haven't. So, it was an interesting race, but nothing. I think it was interesting more for the point that it was something different. It was a track that we hadn't seen before on the schedule, or at least not that the road course part of the Motegi track. So, you know, it gave some freshness and something different to look at from that standpoint. But in terms of racing, it was pretty much more of the same of what we've seen on several of the natural road courses this year, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, there wasn't much movement at front at all. Dixon and Power pretty much just went in circles, but there was a lot more movement toward the back. And there definitely were clear passing zones on this track that the Indy cars were able to use, which hasn't been the case at a couple of road courses that we visit on a regular basis. So from that perspective, I found it more interesting than some of the other races that we've seen this year. I thought that it was not the most exciting that we've ever seen. Obviously, it also wasn't on par with Toronto, which is what some people like and some people don't. But I thought that it was good. I wouldn't give it a 9. I'd maybe give it a 7, but a 7 is not too bad at the end of the day.
I think with a different car that has some different performance characteristics, I think it could be a good track. And like you said, I think there are some good passing zones that, you know, that it kind of winds back and forth on itself, the first 4, 5, 6 corners there.
I'll bet those Formula Nippon cars look pretty good on it, actually.
I would think so. If you had some cars that had a little bit better braking characteristics where you could actually take advantage of some of the sharper turns there at the end of some of those straightaways, I think you could see some decent passing. You know, basically 1 and 2 is more or less a hairpin, and then 3, and I don't know if they consider 3 and 4, which would be that interior hairpin, if you will. I don't think they considered that two separate turns or not. But down there where we saw the Sebastian Bourdais Ryan Hunter Ray incident, that seems like it should be a good passing opportunity. You would think maybe the hairpin before the long turn would be decent, and of course the slow right hander at the end of the long straightaway. You know, there should be 3, 4, 5 passing opportunities on this track, which is a lot better than what we see at, you know, say like a mid-Ohio where you only have one, two or at most three. So, yeah, I think it could be a good track.
Well, it's sort of a moot point because we're not going back, right? But
well, we're not going back for a while anyway.
Yeah, I know. But I thought it was definitely an interesting exercise to see the different track. It was great to be able to take the show to the Japanese people one more time. I think it's the perception from Half a World Away was definitely that it served its purpose mm-hmm. in bringing some joy to the lives of the Japanese people in that region, particularly who suffered so much since the earthquake earlier this year. So that was definitely a great aspect to it. And there was sort of almost a sad feeling of IndyCar saying goodbye when the teams were all pulling out, and hearing rumors of tears being exchanged between the teams and the fans, and you almost kind of felt bad. Like, I had a moment of should we really be doing this? But from a business decision perspective, obviously, it is the right call for IndyCar, although we say that, and yet we're going to China next year, but that's a different matter.
Well, that's unofficial yet, right?
It's all but done. It's all but done.
Yeah.
So just when we think we've got one midnight race off the schedule, we're going to have another one next year. But our friends in that hemisphere were happy. But anyway, from a business perspective, this one's been troublesome for a while, and it's really a shame to abandon so many great fans. But from the perspective of growing the product domestically, it was clearly the right call to let it go.
You know, let's explore that just a little bit more, because I think there were a lot of people that, you know, didn't necessarily enjoy this race, but I don't think people were really against this race until it moved to the fall. You know, for the first several years, IndyCar went there. They went in April, early in the year. And, okay, you break up the beginning of the year a little bit, but you've got plenty of time to regain momentum.
Absolutely. The nail in the coffin for this race was totally that it was in the lead-up to the championship.
Absolutely.
It destroyed all of the momentum.
Yes, this race has destroyed all momentum IndyCar has carried the last several years going into the finale. Mm-hmm. I mean, IndyCar now goes into their last two races basically being off the U.S., calendar for 4 weeks?
Yeah, and their last two races are both competing with the NFL.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty much the fast track to obscurity. It's really a shame, and in past years, it's been, I think last year it was the second last race, wasn't it? And then we finished at Homestead.
And you know, what's a shame is they had such a successful, exciting event at Baltimore where they gained so much momentum, they got so much positive press. And then, you know, they disappear. They go away for 2 weeks, and then they come with an event that nobody's paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And it's another 2 weeks. So basically, you go from Labor Day weekend till the 1st of October without having anything to back up that supporting event. And it happened several years ago. You know, last year they had the event at Chicago, which was another exciting event. And then they disappear for 6 weeks before they basically end their season at Homestead last week.
Where nobody pays attention anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But at least there, I mean, you have the media coverage. I mean, nobody's in the stands, but at least you have American or North American-based media coverage for the event. You know, very, very little at Motegi, unfortunately. Then, yeah, it has just killed the momentum the last couple of years.
I'd be very interested to see the schedule that comes out. I actually had thought that it would be out by now, but I gather from some of the other announcements that have come out in the last week or so that they're waiting for a couple more chips to fall, I think, particularly the circuit at Belle Isle, waiting for the approval from the city council there. Looks like that is more or less settled now, waiting for the sponsorship to get packaged up, but it looks like we will be returning there, and that there may be one or two other things that are waiting to be settled as well. And I also saw, excuse me for not being able to mention who it was because I don't recall, but somebody also mentioned that if Kentucky's not going to be on the schedule next year, which appears to be at least somewhat of a risk, unfortunately, then that's not the sort of thing that you want to announce immediately before the Kentucky race. So I think we might be looking at after the Kentucky race before we actually see anything official, but it will be very interesting to see how it looks when it's all said and done, because there definitely seem to be a few things up in the air, particularly that the China race is scheduled, or rumored to be scheduled for August, and there were three events in August this year in quick succession. So which one or ones of those is going to be gone will be very interesting to see.
Well,
at
it's
least
interesting
one
too, that,
is going to have to be rescheduled.
And some of the events that are on the chopping block this year, we know Milwaukee's gone. That's not coming back. But the other ones that you look at that could be on the chopping block, you're looking at Sonoma,
mm-hmm.
you're looking at New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
you're looking at Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
What do all three of those have in common?
SMI.
They're SMI. A year ago at this time, we were praising SMI for being such a great partner and how, oh, we're so glad that we've gone away from ISC and how SMI has really embraced IndyCar. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, Kentucky gets their race. Their NASCAR race, and all of a sudden IndyCar may be shown the door. New Hampshire put on a really, really good race. They drew the same 30,000, maybe a little less than what Iowa got, yet it doesn't seem like it may be enough to save it. I hope it does, and I kind of just have a hunch that they'll go back next year.
Yeah, I'm not feeling all the angst over not going to New Hampshire either.
I think Randy Bernard and Jerry Gaffin's out there understand that to try a one-year thing just as a shot in the dark was, that doesn't seem like something that either one of them would do. Jerry Gaffin's lobbied too hard for too long to get that race at New Hampshire to give it up after 1 year.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. The only thing that might end up being a sticking point is scheduling a date, because if they are putting China in August, then one would have to think that would be one of the ones that would have to be shuffled. And I can't recall. Does New Hampshire have two cup dates or just the one?
They have two, and they're very
yeah.
close. They're within 6 weeks of each other, I think.
Yeah, so trying to figure out another date that will work, especially in that part of the country
mm-hmm.
where the weather doesn't really allow for a very early or very late season event.
Right.
Rescheduling that would be pretty tricky, I would think.
Yes.
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Anyhow, we've gone way off topic.
No.
Nah. So let's get back to Motegi. Going through the order of events through the race, the first thing that jumps out to me to be worthy of discussion, and if there's something else that comes before this that you want to talk about, Paul, just stop me. But the first thing to my memory that's worth talking about is that yellow flag for JP de Oliveira.
Well, yeah, I can think of something before that, and it was the awful start of it.
Oh, yeah. Do we want to talk about that? Really?
I don't know. That was.
They're all like that now.
No, they're not that bad. That was just.
It was pretty bad, but.
And what I don't understand is why weren't those cars lined up on that back straight?
I don't know, but I don't know what all the shock and awe is about it. Brian Barnhart doesn't throw starts. He doesn't. He's worried about cars plowing into each other if they have to slow down for the yellow, so he just doesn't do it. So. The drivers know that. They do whatever they want. Nobody ever takes anything for it. So that's life in IndyCar.
Oh.
It's not great, but that's the way it is, which is one of the reasons why I'm happy to advocate for standing starts on road and street courses in 2012. And for people who haven't yet seen the article, you can find our Counterpoint article on IndyCar Nation this week. Actually happens to be on this exact subject, where Paul defends maintaining rolling starts, and I have taken the position of supporting IndyCar moving to standing starts in 2012. So if you have an IndyCar Nation account, please do go and check it out. If you don't, why not? It's free. So go and take a look and leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. We can promise you that the people at IndyCar are watching what you have to say on this one. So do go and put your opinions in and let your voice be heard. But anyway, yeah.
Okay. Now you can go on to your other issue.
Oh, we're done with that? Okay. Yes, the yellow flag for JP de Oliveira. Of all the things that happened and all the complaining that people have been doing about the things that race control did during this race, that to me was the most egregious issue from the entire race. I had the biggest issue with that than with anything else.
Really?
And I've seen a lot of people say, oh, you know, this is one place where they should use discretion and they do the right thing, or they did the right thing, and I completely disagree. How can the track be less safe, at whatever period of time? I feel like it was like almost two laps after the incident happens than when the incident happened in the first place. Safety doesn't work like that. If there's a reason for a yellow flag condition to be issued, it needs to happen then.
Because I don't think the safety was for his car sitting there. The safety issue is the safety workers that have to go retrieve him.
When an incident happens, a yellow flag comes out.
It wasn't an incident, though. It's not like there was debris on the track.
Yeah, but it doesn't sit right with me just, you know, waiting until it's convenient. When the incident happens, the yellow flag comes out. Because you get, and this is a common refrain that we've had all season, when you get into situations where you're saying, oh, okay, we're going to use our discretion and we're going to delay the yellow flag, what happens if you do it here and then not in another situation? What if you wait one lap and not two laps and it affects this car and not that car? No. You're getting yourself into all kinds of potential for looking to be using favoritism for different degrees of discretion. It's just a mess. I can't support that at all. And I understand why people are saying, and most of the people I've seen supporting this, to be honest with you, have been drivers. And, of course, the drivers want to see this happen because if they were in the championship battle, they would want to get to do their green flag pit stops before the yellow came out too. But from a fairness of competition standpoint, I hated that. I hated it so much. It's again, race control having an influence on the outcome of the race.
But at the same time, people have constantly complained that there are too many full course cautions on the track when they don't need to be there. Yes or no?
No.
Okay. In this case, if you're not going to retrieve him, there's no need for a full course caution. He wasn't in a particularly precarious spot.
But
where
he needed to retrieve him eventually. The yellow needed to come out eventually, so waiting for it to let the leaders make their pit stops is having an effect on the outcome of the race.
Yeah.
That's not okay. It's not Brian Barnhart's job to decide who gets to pit when. It's his job to police, to be the race director. If there's a situation that requires a yellow, the yellow comes out. What he's doing is affecting the outcome of the race by doing that. And because he did that, he screwed up for Elio, for one thing, and it put Dario in the position on the track that ended up with him getting into the contact that he did in the first place. So it was more than just having an effect on Will and Scott. It never used to be this way.
Did he come out in a different place than he went in?
That I don't recall.
Well, then how do you say he put Dario in that spot?
I don't remember. I just remember at the time thinking Dario would not have been there if the yellow flag had been delayed. And I haven't watched the replay since then, so I can't recall exactly what it was that made me think that. But I'm sure someone will point it out and correct me.
I mean, I guess you could argue that, you know, if the yellow flag comes out and Power and Dixon get shuffled to the back, then Dario's maybe in a different spot.
Yeah, well, I think that might have been what it was. But anyway, that's not how auto racing is supposed to work. If the yellow comes out and you haven't made your pit stop yet, tough luck.
No, I saw that as a fine use of discretion.
Oh, I thought, ugh, awful. Awful. It makes me feel crawly. I hate it.
No. I have no problem with that. I thought that was a fine use of discretion. I don't think that they needed to slow down the race when... I mean, if it would have gone yellow, I could see. It wasn't like it was a car that was crashed on track that, you know, he was presenting a safety hazard to himself or to the competitors. You know, he was just stalled on the track. He didn't need to be retrieved right away. You know, it wasn't that... You know, the full course caution is there to protect the safety workers in those situations. And so long as the safety workers weren't out there right at that time, there was no need for a full course yellow, in my opinion.
I think we might need to write a counterpoint on this and let our readers tell us what they think, because...
Well, I can tell you how that's going to end.
Oh, come on. Paul is under the impression that everybody just agrees with me.
I do.
He just says I'm right.
Maybe. Or it's because you say a boot all the time. I don't know, but nonetheless.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway, we're clearly going to have to agree to disagree on this one, but I would love to hear people out there in the blogosphere weigh in on this one. And I might actually make I'll have to think about it. I might actually make Paul work on his week off and do a bonus counterpoint for Indie Carnation on this one, because I think they...
I'm on the road next week. I don't know if I can pull that one off.
You've got lots of notice.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see. Anyway, so agreeing to disagree on that topic, let's move on and completely agree on the fact that Dario's contact two of his teammates in a third car was the most boneheaded thing you've ever seen out of Dario, possibly in his career. I've never seen him. He doesn't make mistakes like that. What is going on?
Yeah, I can't think of another. Other than the time maybe he ran over Kosuke Matsuura after the checkered flag was out at Kentucky several years ago. But yeah, this is definitely one.
This is up there, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what was going through his head, but is he cracking under the pressure of the championship fight?
I don't think so.
Things going on in the back offices of Target Chip Ganassi Racing that we don't know about? Chip was pissed.
Well, yeah, he just had three of his cars taken out.
I can't recall ever having seen him talk about Dario like that, can you? Dario's the golden boy.
No, I can't ever, no, I don't. I can't think of another time, but...
I've never seen him get like that about Dario. Yeah, I was, like, that was serious. You gotta wonder. I mean, clearly it was with good reason, but...
Yeah. I mean, you had Graham who has just had awful luck all year and just can't get a break. And, you know, he's been taken out by pretty much everyone in the paddock, I think, and now he's been taken out by his own teammate. You know, Charlie was running, what, maybe about eighth or so, somewhere in that ballpark. He had a nice run going. He ended his day. I mean, it killed the whole team other than Dixon.
Mm-hmm. Who was well out of the way in this.
Right.
Pretty much the only reason he got saved. Yeah. No, it was bizarre and very out of character.
Yeah. I don't think he's cracking. I think he just made a mistake.
Yeah, but, I mean...
A mistake he doesn't typically make.
But he doesn't typically make mistakes, but he made the mistake to New Hampshire, too, that was a really, really brutal...
Oh, but I thought that was Sato moved over on him. That's what I heard.
You're drinking the Dario Kool-Aid, huh?
Yeah, that's it.
No, it's, I don't know. New Hampshire, I was willing to just sort of shrug and move on, but now I'm starting to go,
Well, he has seen his lead disappear fairly quickly.
Very quickly. Will is on a roll. Yeah,
but how long will that roll continue now?
Well, that is a good question, but let's leave it to the end. Let's get through Motegi first. Further on this same topic, let's get into the topic from the post that you put up on More Front Wing earlier. As of this recording today, but by the time people hear this, it'll be tomorrow or yesterday. Oh, now I've confused myself. There's a post on More Front Wing. Go read it. It's called Race Control Finally Gets It Right, which is bound to get some people fired up just as a headline, but Paul posits that the penalty that was issued to Dario that sent so many people up in arms is consistent with the penalties that have been issued throughout the rest of the season for the same situation, and that is correct.
Let's first caveat that by up front, I say I don't agree with what the penalty should be.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about, because you're correct to say that IndyCar and Race Control are being consistent with the rule as it has been established and played out for the season, which is that for avoidable contact, a car does a drive-through under green or is sent to the back of the line under yellow, which, if you're going to serve the drive-through under yellow, is effectively the same thing. So it's kind of a drive-through. But I don't think that your interpretation of inconsistency is what other people are seeing as inconsistency. What people are calling inconsistent in this situation is the degree of the penalty, of the severity of the penalty compared to other infractions on track that we've seen this season. And the whole situation gets solved by making a driver, for any avoidable contact penalty, do a drive-through under green once racing resumes.
I agree. Yeah.
Anything else is, I mean, I don't know. I'm going to come out and say, I don't know what they were thinking that a drive-through under green and going to the back of the line under yellow were even close to being the same severity of punishment. So I think you make everybody do the same thing. And I think you made a good point that there's been a lot of contact this year. So maybe that's the solution is, or maybe that's been the root of the problem is that the punishment, because I mean, how often do you have an avoidable contact penalty where racing continues under green? Not that often. So really, if people can more or less count on a yellow flag after an avoidable contact penalty, and all they have to do is go to the back of the line, and that's not much of a penalty, then there's not a whole lot of incentive to not incite the contact in the first place, right?
Well, even going to the back line, it's still not like you get off free. I mean, a lot of these places, it's very difficult to pass. You look at Dario, who, what was he in, about sixth place or something when he got the penalty?
Yeah.
And it took him, and
well,
it took,
exactly where he finished, but it wasn't that far off sixth.
Right, right. I think he finished ninth. So, I mean, it was,
yeah.
And he had to work the whole damn race to get back there. It wasn't like he just went right back there right afterwards. I mean, he had to work very hard the rest of the race to get back there. Now, should an avoidable contact penalty basically kick you out of the race?
It should certainly be more of a penalty than just chipping you to the back.
I mean, okay. How many races are on the road course are usually going to go caution-free or one caution?
Okay.
Okay, so let's say he serves his drive-through penalty. He's not going to go a lap down. So he tools around at the back until the next caution comes out, and now he ends up back there. He's basically in the same place he was.
This kind of comes to another point that has been going through my head for the last little while, is that they do need to look at the fact that they race on ovals and on street courses and road courses and all of different lengths, and a drive-through penalty has much different severity at, say, Iowa than it does at Motegi.
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so the solution, I don't know what it is, but it needs to involve somehow finding parity for the degree of the penalty that you take at different types of courses like that. And I don't know if that means that you write a different rule for roads and for streets and for ovals or shorter ovals or speedways or what that means, but there needs to be some kind of equality there in the severity of relative to the track that you're racing on, what comes out of the penalty.
So is it like an avoidable contact is a two-lap penalty?
Maybe a one-lap penalty. Or maybe I don't know how it would work applying a time penalty. I don't know if that would work.
I agree there probably needs to be something in there looked at over the offseason. And as I said in the article today, I said, you know, I agree with the fact in the people that are saying that as it's written now and as it's enforced now, the punishment doesn't necessarily fit the crime. The punishment is far more lenient than what the crime is. That Dario, in an ideal world, he should have had a much stiffer penalty than what he got.
Mm-hmm.
But inconsistency doesn't mean the lack of rewriting the rules in the middle of the race.
No, I think this
and Dario's penalty of going to the back of the line is consistent with what we've seen.
Consistent with what they've been doing all season, but that's not the inconsistency issue that people are complaining about. The inconsistency that people are complaining about is exactly what you said, the punishment not fitting the crime.
Well, if you listen to the Versus broadcast, that's what they were hammering home. Why isn't he getting the drive-through penalty? He should be getting the drive-through penalty. That was clearly avoidable contact.
That was an issue, yeah, with a lack of understanding from the Versus crew.
And that's what I don't understand. The Versus crew, these guys need to understand that they're... What, they're making
so
this point.
Communicated with the Versus crew what the penalties are for these situations. I mean,
we're 12 races into the season, or 14, or whatever it is. The Versus crew ought to know
by now that it's a drive through under green or back of the line under yellow. So that should have been something that was pretty clear to the announcers. Clearly wasn't in this situation. So
yeah, and I just don't think that. I don't understand why they kept harping on this like this was a different call, like race control Brian Barnhart.
I think the situation in Baltimore created a lot of confusion where Ryan Briscoe was made to do the drive through under green because he hadn't moved to the back of the line yet when the green flag fell. That I know I didn't have a full understanding of what was behind that situation, and I think you mentioned in your article too the Alex Gagliani in Edmonton.
Yeah, that's the oddball one. And I think more than anything, that was a repercussion of the cry from Toronto, basically. You know, it came off Toronto where everyone's like, we need more penalties. And I think it was probably just a knee-jerk reaction. And that's why Tagliani was kind of the unfortunate recipient of that drive-through. But if you toss that out, they've been consistent the rest of the year. And if you toss out that one example, you have one example, basically, where you have an inconsistency.
Anyway.
I can't think of it. That's what happened to Elio at St. Pete. It happened to Elio at Long Beach. It happened to Paul Tracy at Long Beach. It happened to Conway. It happened to, you know, probably half a dozen guys at Toronto. Happened to Conway at Edmonton. You know, that's been consistent throughout the year, is you go to the back of the line.
Think the Briscoe situation wasn't well explained, and that, again, could come down to the Versus crew. It's hard to say. But I think that was what had a lot of – because that was the one that was immediately on in people's memory when they saw what happened here. So that's my take on it, that people didn't really know why Briscoe had been made to do the drive-through. Well, they kind of did, but they didn't fully understand it. Because, I mean, Ryan told us that he didn't think that it was safe for him to get to the back of the line under yellow. And so because he wasn't able or wasn't given enough time or whatever the situation was to get to the back under the yellow flag, he ended up doing the drive-through, which was a far more severe penalty at the end of the day. So, I mean, that can bring up a whole lot of questions about should he have been given another lap to get to the back, if he was right and it wasn't safe, was that the right call on race control's part? That's a whole slew of different discussions. But at the end of the day, that, I think, is what people had in mind when they were saying, well, why didn't he get a drive-through? Because Briscoe just did. So it doesn't make it right, but it explains it.
I think it's just people are out.
I still think that the Versus made it looked pretty bad to have the booth absolutely slamming race control the way that they did. It was almost insubordinate.
I agree, and obviously I think a lot of it is probably driven by one person sitting in the Versus booth. But by and large, I mean, your TV announcers need to understand what the rules are. And they certainly need to understand. How many races has Versus broadcast this year? 9? Something like that. I mean, they should understand what the precedents are in different situations. I mean, you
they
and
should,
I are getting
paid. I mean, they should also understand that Ryan Briscoe's first name is not Kevin. So.
Very true. It is true. So, and to be fair, gosh, he made that mistake, and then he corrected himself about, what, 3 seconds later, and people just rode him the rest of the night about it? Good grief, it was a slip of tongue.
Yeah, but poor Bob has had a lot of those this year.
Well, maybe he has, but at least he recognized this one right away. It wasn't like he came back 15 laps later and said, oh, did I mess that up? No.
No, I know, but it does look kind of bad. I have to agree on that.
True, but it also looks bad for the fandom that's just out for blood, and they're just out to nail any and
everyone. No, I didn't take it as that at all. I thought people were just having fun with it.
I don't know. It's hard to tell when people are so vocal about every single little matter. I mean, it's gotten to the point where, to be honest, it's almost not even fun to watch along with Twitter or Trackform anymore, because it's just the same nitpicking, narcissistic, and they're just out looking for every excuse to nail somebody to the wall.
That's interesting, because I found that one of the most entertaining things about watching the race on Saturday night was sitting with everybody on Twitter.
Well, I used to think that.
I found that this weekend. I thought that people were having a grand old time. Maybe you just take things too seriously.
That's probably, they were probably all sleep drunk by that night, by that point.
Well, there were definitely some people that were a little inebriated.
Well, actually inebriated, yeah. I was just going for the, the sleep deprived, punch happy, or, they were just sleep deprived happiness. I don't know.
I was having a grand old time. I think you're a curmudgeon. You're getting old, Bob Balby.
I already am old. That's, I mean, maybe not quite as old as some of us on the line, but you know.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Well, I don't know. I could be talking about a lot of people that could be listening right now.
Anyway, are we done talking about this? Can we move on?
Are you still talking?
We have entirely too much fun doing this. Do we have anything to say about the Ryan Hunter-Reay and Sebastian Bourdais contact?
No.
I don't either.
I'm sure people are complaining why it is.
We're complaining about that too. You know what? I gotta say, I think I haven't seen the replay off the top of my head, and I shouldn't be saying this type of thing off the top of my head. I should be backing it up with evidence, but bear with me. My guess is that Versus didn't show the incident far back enough for people to make their own accurate judgment.
It wouldn't have mattered if they did anyway.
No, don't be so pessimistic. I think that all that people saw was the part where Ryan got punted into the sand. But the incident actually started a good two turns before that.
True, but they did show them, the two of them entering turn three, and you could see that, I mean, they were wheel to wheel. It wasn't a case where Sebastian barely got his right front to Ryan's left rear. I mean, he was all the way alongside,
mm-hmm.
and then Ryan Hunter-Reay kind of drove it deeper into the corner, so maybe it looked a little worse when the contact actually came about.
Yeah, that's, I think, what had people up in arms, because they didn't really see what led into it. But when you looked at the full situation, it definitely was a racing incident, and I didn't have any issue with the situation there. Or
are
with the
agreeing?
Race control.
Are we agreeing?
I don't want to admit to it.
Go away.
Let's disagree and talk about Elio Castroneves.
How can we disagree? We already agreed on this before, didn't we?
Did we?
I don't know. I thought we did over.
We justified.
All right, give me your wrong opinion.
What if you agree with me? Are you saying you're wrong?
Well, apparently I'm not.
Anyway, no, I think you might be right. We might agree at least on part of this. The penalty was fully justified, in my opinion. These are professional race car drivers. If you've ever driven on a kart track, you know. Especially if you go to Fast Times in Indianapolis and you try to stay at race speed under yellow, you learn real fast. That's not something that you do.
You can do anything once in life, right?
Yeah.
That's one that you usually don't do the second time.
No, not at Fast Times, because they will not hold back when they're telling you about the track marshals having their safety put at risk. And, they just lay right into you. So if they'll do that on a kart track, the IndyCar drivers certainly should know better. And that that is part of what played into the severity of the penalty here. And, again, they're being consistent with what they've done in other situations, late race situations. Because, I mean, when it happens on, what was it, the second last lap?
Oh, it was the last lap.
Yeah, what are they going to do? They can't make him do a drive-through. Race is over. So what's the equivalent result to making him do a drive-through? It's putting him at the end of the lead lap. I don't have an issue with that. He, by passing under yellow, he puts himself at risk. He puts the other car's driver at risk, and he puts track workers at risk who are out dealing with the situation. So he absolutely should have known better, and he absolutely was at fault. And the penalty, severity of the penalty fit the crime, in my opinion.
Agreed.
Okay, so there's nothing to disagree on there.
I don't understand what Elio is throwing the fit about, is what I don't get.
People seem to be under the impression that he was partly annoyed by the call with the yellow flags. I think he's just using it as an excuse to
You mean he didn't think a yellow flag should have been thrown when there was a car sitting on the side of the track?
No, the situation we talked about earlier where the yellow was delayed to let Hill and Dixon do their green flag stops. I think he came out on the short end of that situation.
Hmm.
So I think that was a contributing factor there. Or at least that was what some people theorized. I didn't see it that way. He was pretty vocal about having an issue with going from 7th to 22nd.
And it follows precedent of what they've done.
It does. And it's just his bad luck that there weren't fewer cars on the lead lap, right? I mean, if you're somewhere like Iowa, off the top of my head, I can't tell you off the top of my head how many cars were on the lead lap at the end of the race at Iowa, but I'm sure it wasn't 22.
No, probably not many, right.
No. So, I mean, if you do something like that there, it's not as much of a penalty as it is somewhere like here where it's a really long course. But I don't know what you can do to mitigate that in this type of circumstance.
Right. And if this had happened 10 laps earlier and he serves his drive-through, he goes to the back of the lead lap anyway.
No, I didn't have an issue with it once I thought it through. My initial reaction was, yeah, maybe he should have just given the position back. But then a couple of people pointed it out to me, drivers in particular, saying, yeah, you don't mess around with local yellows.
Well, that, and, you know, it's the same thing that happened to Georgia Patino at, where was it, Sonoma. It happened to Danica Patrick at St. Pete. You know, when you get a penalty on the last lap, you have to enforce it somehow. You don't get a free pass on your penalty just because it's the last lap.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he's feeling pressure, too. I don't know, but...
Oh, I'm sure he's feeling pressure.
For him?
He drives with one car from the look of things at Penske, so...
So for him to lay in like that, I was just shocked when I read that.
Well, and that's a good point, is that Roger historically doesn't really like his drivers to be quite so vocal, so... If he is feeling pressure to make himself look worthy of that seat, it's surprising to see him being so vocal, unless he thinks that he needs to prove his point, to prove that he wasn't wrong, but that's not usually the way that a Penske driver goes about things.
No, and especially in this case where I think 90% of the rest of the paddock would agree that he was in the wrong. I mean, this just doesn't make you look very good to go on a tirade like that and to call Brian Barnhart, you know, every name under the sun and say that, you know, his rules are amateurish and call him a circus clown and say that he basically doctors the rule book to meet his own personal interests. It just, I don't know, to me it just reeks of unprofessionalism, and, you know, maybe now that he's had some time to cool off, he feels bad about saying it, but there's, you know, being a...
Well, I'm sure his pocketbook will... give him some opportunity to cool off, too.
Oh, I'm sure it will. But, you know, at the same time, these are professionals that need to keep their emotions in check a little bit better than this. I mean, I agree. I want to see emotion, but not stupidity. I mean, willpower, I consider emotion. I mean, but this ordeal with Elio is...
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This is going too far. When you accuse
off the cuff, but this would have had to have been premeditated.
I mean, he made these comments on Twitter.
Yeah.
Easily an hour after the race. It wasn't like he had just climbed out of the car and got the news. I mean, he had time to think about these comments. He knew what he was saying, and he still took the time to type them out. And I mean, these are pretty serious accusations against the senior official of IndyCar to say that he's basically doctoring the race for his own personal interest. I mean,
did you see Paul Tracy's comments back to him?
No, I missed it.
He said, he told Elliot, dude, last time I called a chief steward a circus clown, it cost me $50,000. You might want to calm down.
Well, and I don't think I don't think Roger Penske will be quite as eager to pay Elio's fine as he was. Will Power's fine after.
No, I wouldn't think so. But despite this, and despite the fact that Elio has been absolutely being a circus clown himself, if I may say so, with not quite getting his left foot braking right at the road and street courses this year, I think in spite of that, we'll still see him in car number two for Penske next year, and it's looking more and more like Ryan Briscoe's going to be on the outside looking in.
Yeah, that's a shame. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not as convinced about that as everyone else is. And I understand the reasoning that, you know, why people continue to say that. But, you know.
Elio's marketable. People know who he is. Nobody, you can't, I bet you I couldn't find. It would be a pretty good search to find somebody in America who knows who Ryan Briscoe is.
Well, that may be, but it's not like...
It all comes down to the money, Paul. How many cars this year have had Penske Truck Wrestle on the side of them? Roger doesn't like to pay for cars.
Well, okay. What full-time sponsor has LDO's marketability brought him?
None yet, but...
Exactly.
No,
I mean, if LDO has...
Shell commercials right now, or Pennzoil commercials.
True. But the Shell and the Pennzoil aren't sitting on his car very often.
No, but I think they're using that money to fund both programs right now.
I don't know. I understand he has marketability and he has a personality to him, but you got to remember he's also probably getting a little bit closer to the twilight of his career. How much longer is he going to be driving? Is Briscoe somebody that Penske wants to keep around long time? Or for the long run, I don't know. I'm not saying Briscoe's certainly going to be back there, but I just don't think it's quite as set in stone that Elio's the guy over Briscoe.
We'll see you be wrong next year.
I admit that it's more likely that Elio's in that car than Briscoe.
Yeah.
But I'm just not ready to say it's set in stone that Elio basically has a free pass just because he has three Indianapolis wins.
Well, we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting. Definitely something to watch. And it's hard. I find it hard to believe that Ryan Briscoe wouldn't land somewhere else if he were to find himself.
Oh, yeah. You have to think he ends up somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See what happens. So let's talk about the championship. We have a new leader. Will Power not only took home the Mario Andretti trophy at Motegi, and I have to throw in that it's a real shame that he had to give that trophy away at Motegi because it got absolutely no exposure for it whatsoever.
Did they actually give them trophy there?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. They did. You didn't know that, did you?
I did not know that.
I mean, that's just bad luck with the way the schedule turned out this year. Motegi wasn't supposed to be a road course. It was supposed to happen at Baltimore, but such is life, and... So Will Power now has the Mario Andretti Trophy sitting on his mantle and is leading the overall championship by 11 points. Is that enough?
No. No.
I don't know. With the way that Dario's been performing for the last month or so, I'm tending to think it's going to be close.
I don't know.
Very
I think
close.
I think the Penskes have been out to lunch on the ovals this year. I mean, look. Will wasn't even in. He wasn't even in TV mention at Iowa or New Hampshire. Now, granted, those are both very different courses than where we're going to finish up this year. And he did get his quote-unquote win at Texas this year. But
yeah, half a win. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but keep in mind that Tim Cindric wasn't put on his card until Toronto.
Agreed.
And New Hampshire's the only oval we've had since then.
Yeah, but he was toasted at New Hampshire.
Not really. By the end of the race.
Well, by the end of the race, he clawed back in. That was, you know, more of a matter of attrition, I think, than anything else.
Well, and are you saying that surviving attrition is not a valuable driver skill?
I'm saying that it's unlikely that Dario is not going to, unless something happens, he gets taken out. I can't even tell you the last time.
How can you know the way that the New Hampshire race turned out, where, as you say, Sato turned into Dario, and Will made it to the end until the restart that shall be named, but shall not be named. But but how can you look at that and say that things are just going to turn out the same as
I'm
they
not saying with absolute certainty. I'm just saying you have to, at some point, you have
huge.
To consider the odds and the percentages. And if you look at their body of work, Dario just doesn't not finish on the mile-and-a-half race. I can't even tell you the last mile-and-a-half track that Dario didn't finish on or run well. I mean, the last big oval I can think he didn't do well on was when he backflipped down the back straight at Michigan in 2007. I don't know if he has a DNF on a mile and a half since then.
I don't believe he has, because I think up until New Hampshire he had some ridiculously long finishing streak on all types of courses,
yeah.
If I remember correctly.
So, I mean, certainly, you obviously can't say, no, Dario's going to finish and probably win the race. I'm just saying, I think he has the advantage over Will Power. 11 points is nothing.
11 points is nothing, but I think that Tim Cindric throws a huge wild card into the situation.
Yes. Where Cindric is going to help more than anything, though, again, as I've said before, I think it's the pit strategy. I don't think we've seen it.
Well, and over and over again, you've seen me argue that other than Homestead, which was entirely Will's fault, every oval race that he had a poor result on last year was because of his crew, not him.
Well,
if you sit down and look at the statistics, it bears out. And this year started out the same way. He had the same issues at Indianapolis, for sure. I'm trying to think of where else. There was definitely the wheel that came off on the pit stop at Indianapolis.
And I can't think of what happened to him in the first race at Texas, but I don't remember any of the Penske cars.
It's been almost entirely his team. People keep saying he's bad on ovals, but it hasn't really been him, with the exception of Homestead. Homestead was awful.
Right.
He choked. That was awful. But other than that...
Is it in his head, though? Is it a mental thing? I don't know.
You know what? That is a possibility, and that's what lost him the championship last year. I mean, if you look at Homestead as being the be-all and end-all, and you win and lose championships over the full season, right? But
I'll agree, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would tend to agree with you, but I think Will has shown more calm in the later stages of this year. I think earlier this year, he was sort of seeming to be rattled when Dario was getting ahead of him. But in these last few races, he's rallied. And I think Cindric's probably had a lot to do with that.
Now the tide has turned a little bit, though, and now he has to again defend a lead.
Yeah,
it'll be curious to see how he plays like that.
He will be, but I think he's doing a better job now of racing each race and not concerning himself too much with the championship. I can't recall when exactly it was. I think it was around Toronto, because that was when Will was really starting to look rattled.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex Tagliani and Will are fairly good friends, I think. But Alex said that he had said to Will that he needed to remember how to have fun racing and do what he loves to do and not worry about the championship so much. And I think, I'm guessing, but it seems to me from watching Will since then that he's taken it to heart.
Seems to be. And he had the big deficit at one point. What was it, like 60 points or something like that?
It was bad. Yeah, it was more than a race.
Yeah, it was a big deficit. And, you know, I think I said at the time that, you know, now maybe it's a luxury that he can get away from having to think about points and do what he does best, and that's just pedal to the floor, balls to the wall driving, where he does absolutely best, where he can just go no holds barred, no consequence, and really get going. And, you know, since that time, we've seen him just chip away fairly quickly, really, what is it, about four races. I mean, he's stormed back.
Yeah, it's been really impressive, actually.
Yeah.
And Dario has contributed to it as well. But yeah, I think if he can keep it up, I think it's going to be right down to the wire. And IndyCar is good for that.
But
so,
yeah,
NASCAR, you don't need a chase.
No, but 11 points, though, is just nothing. I mean, that's the difference between first and second in a pole, or most laps left, I think, isn't it?
I thought the difference between first and second was 20 points, wasn't it?
No, I think it's 10. I think it was 50 to 40.
Oh, yeah, I think
50,
right.
40, 35, I think.
Yeah, of course. My bad. Anyway, let's just go over. We're getting pretty short on time here. Let's quickly go over a couple of news items before we wrap up. The 2012 IndyCar tested at Iowa Speedway earlier this week, and our boy Press Dog was there. And he was working it for the fans. There's all kinds of photos posted, and he had a great interview with Dan Weldon as well. So head on over to PressDog.com and check it out. Of course, if you're listening to us, you probably already have, but we got to give the dog a love. So the other things to mention, the test at Kentucky on Friday, I think is something like 11 cars.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Yep. Yeah, running this Friday, and it's open to the public. So if you're in the area, head on over and see some Indy cars a week ahead of your race. So let's talk about just quickly about Vegas. There's a couple different aspects of this to discuss. Trackside Online, another good bunch of guys and friends of ours, and a group that you definitely should be subscribing to. It's only $22 a year, and it's worth every penny. Trackside Online is reporting that 33 cars right now are signed up for Vegas, and I don't believe that includes Dylan Battistini, who is testing, or is he just testing for Kentucky? Yeah, because he's going to run the seat that was Saavedra's at Kentucky, but I don't think anybody's quite sure where that's going to end up for Vegas yet. Depends on whether Sebastian comes up with some money, I think. So anyway, it's 33 as of now, and there's plenty of time for more to show up, and these cars become scrap at the end of that race, so I wouldn't be surprised to see more, which will make things very interesting, and I'm sure Dan Weldon cringes every time he sees another announcement of another car that he has to get past to win his $2.5 million and share it with the give another $2.5 million to a fan. I don't think we've had a chance to talk about this yet on the podcast. Just a quick impression, Paul, of the rehashed $5 million challenge for Vegas.
It's kind of a shame how it worked out, but they had to do something. And I know there's a lot of drivers and teams that are kind of upset with the way it's worked out, and you know the fact that only Dan Weldon is eligible for this now as the winner of the 500. And
I don't know what they wanted them to do.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, that showed up that were actually going to move the needle, Randy's right.
Yeah.
There were like three guys that signed up that actually would have done it. Zanardi would have been awesome, but he only wanted to drive for Ganassi, and Ganassi said, no, we're going to focus on the title. Casey Kane wanted to do it, but Casey Kane would only drive with Penske, and Penske said, no, we want to focus on the title. And then Travis Pastrana broke his ankle. I mean, what did they want?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's disappointing that some of the drivers were so close-minded toward looking at other teams, though. I mean, I think we've talked about this before. I think Panther could have put a good car out there. I think Newman Haas could have put a good car. I think KV Racing could have put a good car out there. Are they winning cars? I don't know. I don't know if they are or not. I don't know if any car.
The evidence kind of bears out to know.
Well, probably, yeah. But
and
the evidence also kind of bears out to the fact that the evidence also bears out to the fact that driving, you know, jumping into a car, even if you jump into a Penske or a Ganassi, you're not going to necessarily win the first time out.
No, but your chances are definitely better. Anyway, given the options that they had, I thought that the Weldon angle was pretty good. I don't know how if it's really going to move the needle that much.
Probably not. No.
But it's better than running home with their tail between their
legs.
Yeah,
you couldn't do the CART Hawaiian Super Prix thing. You couldn't announce a $10 million prize and then renege on it.
No.
You had to do something.
It was really their best option of what was put in front of them. So one last point on the Vegas thing. For those fans who do have a Twitter account, you may have noticed over the weekend that Randy Bernard has joined us on Twitter. His handle is RBIndyCar, and when he gets to 5,000 followers, he's going to tell us something about the Vegas Challenge, or about the Vegas race, excuse me, some big exciting thing that's going to happen that no other racing series, top-level racing series, has had the opportunity to do. So go and follow him and tell your friends, and let's see what Randy has up his sleeve this time.
Of how far he's even gotten right now. I don't know.
I know he's over 4,000.
He was at like 4,200 last I saw. So
I'm a little bit, frankly, embarrassed that it's taken this long. It should. I mean, the IndyCar account has, 18,000 or something like that. But anyway.
Tony Kanaan's got, 350,000?
Yeah. Tony really should put a tweet out there. But anyway. I don't think there's anything else for us to discuss unless you have anything that pops to mind, Paul.
Drawing a blank. I think we've covered most of the news coming up.
I think we did, and we managed to fill an hour just the two of us blabbing, so.
See? Told you it could be done.
Yeah, well, we're good at talking, aren't we? Okay,
that's a whole hour people get to listen to your lovely Canadian accent.
It's a whole hour they don't get back. Anyway. So speaking of hours, we won't get back. We'll be back next week, and we will. I will. We'll give you a little preview of the race next weekend at Kentucky, and we should be able to find somebody else to talk to by then as well.
Yeah, if you're a driver and you want to come talk to us, send us a message. We'll be glad to let you be on.
Be careful what you wish for. Anyway, on that note, let's call it a day. So we'll thank all of you at home for listening, taking the time to spend with us today, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. But remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more, covering the IZOD IndyCar series and beyond.
Hi, this is Tony Ganon, and you need more front wing, and I love that. That's my favorite word when I tell my engineer.